So why'd you switch to podcasts?
It's weird, but there wasn't enough listening. Hi, I'm Brandy Easter.
And I'm Meg Markwart. We're both PhD candidates at the Composition and Rhetoric program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
In this audio component of our Praxis chapter, we're going to share the origins of the class and assignment structure.
We'll then walk through a student example from my fall 2017 course.
And we'll talk about some questions we're still thinking about.
Brandy, why don't you start us off? Because you are the original class designer, but it looked a lot different the first time you taught it, right?
Yeah, so English 201 felt like a bit of a daunting class to teach because the structure and the content is so open. It fulfills a communications requirement, but what you do with that is pretty flexible. And so although we've both taught courses with more standardized structures, this is the first time I've taught a class that felt truly my own.
And doing that for the first time is hard.
Yeah, hard but exciting. I really wanted to use this opportunity to think about anti-racist, anti-sexist pedagogy. I used a grading contract. I themed the course Bad Writing, which focused on asking what our rules about writing are, why, and what the consequences are. And all of this was accomplished through collaborative audio essays exploring research on writing rules.
And everything you taught was brand new, right?
Yeah, this was the first time I went into my class with the goal of being actively and explicitly anti-racist and anti-sexist in my teaching. And though I loved how the content was working toward these goals, I wasn't making the best use of the structure and assignments.
Huh, what wasn't working with the assignments?
Well, I noticed a couple things. Revisions weren't happening. Once an audio draft was made, it was very unlikely to undergo major revisions. I also found that groups didn't have many opportunities to practice collaborating, since they only made one audio essay altogether. And ultimately, what was lost somehow seemed to be listening.
What do you mean?
Well, I'm thinking of Krista Radcliffe's rhetorical listening, deliberate listening that helps the whole class investigate and interrogate their own positionalities and the positionalities of their research.
Got it. So what did you change?
Well, I changed the theme, but the major change was switching from audio essays to podcasts. I wanted to focus on collaboration and listening, and so podcasts, as serial and iterative projects, made the heart of the class about practicing research as a feminist act of listening, reflecting, and collaborating.
By the time you changed the course to podcasting, I already knew I would steal it when I started to teach my own 201 course.
Not stealing, Meg. Collaborating.
The course has three sequences: the idea pitch, the collaborative research phase, and a final revision. And each students are creating podcasts to try to solve a mystery, broadly defined as any question they can't answer by a Google search or asking an expert.
Yeah, I brought this approach to the course from Caroline Levine's work on suspense and mystery fiction to present research as a mystery and research methods as ways of knowing.
So how does this class start?
Well, in the first sequence, we set up podcasts as a genre and understand how research is like solving a mystery. The capstone assignment is to make a short 3 to 5 minute episode that introduces a mystery they want to explore in the next sequence.
Yeah, I call that first episode a trailer, meaning they should tell a story in a compelling way that draws listeners into the question.
Then in sequence 2, which I really think is the heart of the course, we spend a week teaching, forming, and building collaborative practices around the most compelling mysteries. Then students in groups of 3 or 4 produce a weekly 5-minute podcast episode that examines their mystery from a different research method.
We start with traditional research, like Google or library searches, move to interviews, observation testing, archival research, and then deduction and hypothesizing.
Finally, sequence 3 is a 15 to 20 minute revision of all this hard work into a standalone audio essay, much like an episode of Radiolab or Reply All.
Because one of the most exciting things about this course to us is the iterative and serial nature of podcasting, we're going to focus on only one student example so that we can walk through the process of the class.
So the example we're going to focus on is from your class in fall 2017. So do you want to introduce it, Meg?
Sure. This is a podcast about Robert Grunenwald, a man at the heart of a UW-Madison urban legend.
Okay, but I've never heard of Robert Grunenwald.
I hadn't either, maybe because we weren't undergrads here. But on campus, he's known as Tunnel Bob.
To give you a little bit of an idea about the environment down here, it's extremely hot, blisteringly hot. We've been walking for, I don't know, probably 30 minutes in tunnels going in mostly one direction. We went out under Engineering Hall. Tunnel Bob seems like a really good guy. He's waiting for us and kind of letting us do our own thing, explore the tunnels as we wanted to. We should keep going though.
Why tunnels? What is it about tunnels that you like? Is it like something about the underground?
Not just tunnels. Steam tunnels are what I like.
If it's just an ordinary tunnel, I don't care much for it.
But why the steam? It's not the heat aspect, is it?
More mystery item.
That's students from one of the student newspapers, the Badgered Herald, interviewing Grunenwald. It's rumored that he spends much of his time alone in the steam tunnels that run under campus.
Okay, so what's the mystery here? Like, what did your students want to find out?
So the student who started this had heard stories about him popping up in unexpected places and lingering late into the night in libraries, scaring hapless undergrads. He's described as spooky and abnormal, so I was nervous from the beginning.
What were you concerned about?
I didn't want the podcast to end up further characterizing Grunenwald as an outsider or an other. As the student who pitched this mystery, Abby, notes in her first episode, she's already thinking about how the strangeness of the legend had led to some problematic characterizations of Grunenwald, characterizations that she wants to challenge. Here's Abby in her first episode.
Tunnel Bob is a genuine person with genuine emotions, interests, and ambitions, but his attraction to these tunnels kind of distracts everyone from his humanity. His past might have a serious impact on why he does what he does in the present, but his life story is uncharted territory. That is the mystery I'm attempting to unravel in this podcast. Who is the genuine Tunnel Bob, and why does he spend so much time in the tunnels?
So where did this project go next?
Carly and Emily joined Abby's group, and they first interviewed their peers about their experiences with Grunenwald, which were, to their surprise, overwhelmingly positive. They next tried observing, which was a research method they struggled with. Not only could they probably not observe Grunenwald, they also didn't want to observe him, knowing that he's not a participating research subject. Instead, they tried hanging out in spaces Grunenwald usually spotted to see how people act.
Okay, so I want to talk about the archive episode, because in listening to them, this is where I felt a lot of interesting things happened.
That's where everything happened. We took a trip to the university archives, where the archivist David Knoll pulled several yearbooks and newspapers that referenced Grunenwald. Watching them flip through the pages was a great moment, because I could see in real time as their research questions pivoted.
For generations, Tunnel Bob has been a name we like to associate with the creepy underground system, and we never stop to think how or why this came about.
Overall, the archives really showed us that over time, Robert Grunenwald has morphed into a semi-fictitious character named Tunnel Bob. Students and community members like to have something to talk about. They don't care or know much about the steam tunnel system and its importance, but when they learned that a guy likes to spend time down there, it suddenly became so much more interesting.
So in response to their findings, their question shifts.
Right. They stopped asking questions about Grunenwald and started asking questions about themselves and the UW campus as a whole.
This is also where your students stop using the name Tunnel Bob, right?
Yeah, or if they do use it, it's in quotes because they're referencing other people calling him Tunnel Bob. They just start calling him Robert.
So where does this group end up?
By the final revision, they are fully focused on presenting a story that puts a wider UW campus under the microscope.
After weeks of research that began with a desire to know more about an urban legend on our campus, our focus turned and made us wonder why we are so obsessed with him. We're now left asking ourselves what it says about us that we've spent decades continuing to talk about and be fascinated by him.
The Tunnel Bob Project is an instructor's dream. It does everything I hope for in terms of listening to research. They really let the research guide their questions week to week, allowing them to create a thoughtful and thought-provoking audio essay.
Not all of your students picked mysteries that took on a question so explicitly about identity, though, right?
Right. But I was surprised at how the process of listening through research often brought students to these kinds of questions. For example, one project about a stolen flag from a house party ended up also reflecting on race and national identity.
I'm also really interested in how the iterative nature of podcasting emphasized collaboration and listening to each other.
Me too. I was actually surprised by how much of that sort of listening was going on I wasn't aware of. I think that was my biggest takeaway from teaching this semester.
What do you mean, Meg?
For example, another group noted in their final reflections how they had two really dominant voices in the group. They all noted how the emphasis on listening helped them learn to navigate what could have been potentially a really tough semester of working together.
And you had no idea they had that issue?
Not at all. They worked through it all on their own by being careful to allow everyone's ideas to be heard. And not knowing what was going on makes me think about how I can keep changing this course in the future to better emphasize listening and collaboration. What was your takeaway from teaching this course, Brandy?
I think for me, the course helped me see how soundwriting can afford thinking about listening as an embodied feminist practice.
And the iterative nature of podcasting emphasized reflection and collaboration.
Yeah, I love getting to see groups learn not only how to work with sound, but how to better listen to each other. So you're teaching this class again now, Meg. What are you thinking through?
So I'm changing the order of research methods. They could go in any order, but I wanted to move archives earlier because of the shifts, like the one in this example about Grunewald. I'm also doing a lot more grounding in the beginning, helping students think through storytelling and critical listening skills. There are always more pieces to this course to figure out, but I think we're getting closer.
We hope these resources are helpful to your next sound writing project, and we'd love to hear about your experiences with it.
We'd also love to hear student stories if they're willing to share. The projects produced in this assignment are always fascinating.
Good luck with your sound writing.